Seriously. Okay. Where were we? So I was talking about... this is starting in the middle of things. Sorry for those listening to the recording. So I was talking about preemptive multitasking and talking about threads, multi-process preemptive multitasking versus multi-threaded preemptive multitasking. Threads are in general lower overhead than processes, but in either case, they're more overhead than not having any of this, not having any switching, just doing it all in one process. And so there you have to think, wait, this is a bit of programming jujitsu, really. How do I do concurrency on my own manually? Which means, so now you have to break down, what am I going to do in the service of a request? So a request comes into the server. The easiest way to handle this, well, let's assume this is a static file server, and a static web server. So, incoming request, I want / index. Now that I've got this index.html, what I need to do? I need to parse request. Get resources, I read the file, process resources,
render response.
That's what I mean by process the resources. And then process response. Now, what you could do, making a single-threaded server, is you just do these sequentially. You do this, and then you could say, wait for request. You just go through, for each request coming in, you could do this sequentially, and then, so after this, now this is waiting, and then once you do this, you go, and then wait for the next request. So this would mean that any next request that comes in would have to be wait to be served until the current request has been finished processing. So that's not how we want to do things. That's not good enough. Because some of these requests will take longer than others to service. And some of the requests might be able to do it really quick. So we want to handle things as quickly as we can. So we need to interleave these things. One request has to be being processed. While it's being processed, another one has to come in. But I can't, the multi-threaded or multiple process, forks model, would say do each of these things in a separate process or in a separate thread. If they're in separate processes, you don't have to do any coordination because they have separate copies of their memory. If they're within the same process and as multiple threads, they share memory, and so you have to use locks to make sure they don't mess with each other. But now, I don't want either of that. I want to interleave these in the body of my code. So this requires picking apart this and figuring out what takes so long. And in general, this is the slow part. This is I.O. I.O. is slow. Very, very slow relative to your CPU. You're waiting on the disk. You're reading the file. If it was already in memory, maybe it would be faster, but otherwise it might be really slow. Maybe there's a lot of things going off the disk. You don't know how long this is going to take. So what you want to do is while you're waiting on this to happen, you want to be able to process an incoming request. You want to be able to receive it and start parsing it. This is the basic design around something like Node. is you do this manually. And that is what callbacks are all about, is making this, is breaking this up. The guy, I forget his name, but the guy who designed Node, the reason why he picked JavaScript originally as the language to use was not because he wanted to use JavaScript per se, but it was because the V8 engine of Google, you know, for JavaScript had come out and it was really, really fast, and he knew that JavaScript had no pre-existing file I/O library.
Reindahl.
Okay. So, Reindahl. So, he looked at this and said, let me implement my own I/O library, and then I can do this. So, why is that important? Why is it important to implement your own I/O library if you want to do something like this where you manually have these, you know, manually manage concurrency because you have all these callbacks? So what we have to have is what is known as non-blocking. So observation has shown that when you have multiple threads running or multiple processes, most of the time what they're doing is waiting for I/O. Waiting for the disk, waiting for other network connections. They're just sitting around doing nothing. So instead of them existing and doing nothing, we're going to manually say, okay, that we made that request, and instead of waiting, we're going to do something else. So this is like, you're sitting there cooking in the kitchen, and you're doing some task, and you go like, oh, I just put something in the oven. I've got to wait for 5 minutes. Well, you know, while that, you know, browns a little bit. What am I going to do? I've got 5 minutes. I can't do a lot. Well, maybe I could clean. If you interleave your cleaning with your cooking, kitchen is much less messy afterwards. That's your roommate. So the idea of non-blocking, but so how, what does it mean to do non-blocking I/O? So when I say blocking I/O, I mean when you do things like a read, what are its semantics? Norm in most programming languages, when you do a read, you wait until the read finishes. You make the request to disk, and your program doesn't do any more computation until the result of the read has returned. If it's an asynchronous I/O, if it's a non-blocking I/O call, you make the read request, and if the data is not immediately available, it just returns. And it says, the data's not there yet. Sorry. And so what do?
Oh, I hold on.
You try again. Later. Now, should you try again immediately? No. Ideally, you should try again when the system tells you, oh, I have the data now. So generally, with any sort of asynchronous thing, you say, could you give me index.html, please? And it says, I don't have it for you right now. I'll tell you later when I have it. Then, okay. Go do your work. I've got index.html. Oh, okay, now let me finish that request. That's the logic of your code. That's what the callbacks are in Node, is you're breaking up your computation this way. So let's try to visualize this.
But the non-blocking nature of it has to do with serving other requests, not necessarily.
Right, it does not
being the pointer within the code that has made the recall.
Well, by adding in these callbacks, you don't make the serving of that first index.html any faster. It's going to take as long as it's going to take because you got to wait for the disk. But what you make it is so that you can now handle other requests while you're waiting. They become interleaved, and you control the interleaving via callbacks. So what does that look like? So one way to think of it is there is an event loop. We can say this is a little, you know, it's going around and around, and it's got various tasks to do. This is at the heart of Node. these come and go. These, you have this similar kind of structure in a standard operating system, but each of these things to run would be a process or a thread, and they'd only be given a certain amount of execution time. In something like Node, each of these runs to completion. So this is known as cooperative multitasking. Meaning that if any of these things misbehaves, they can take over everything. They can lock up the entire server. So your task then as a programmer comes not so much trying to manage concurrency, but to manage the size of these pieces. And what an asynchronous call does is it forces you to break up your code. So you'll have a function and making a call. So the node convention is you have some number of arguments to a function, with the last one being a callback function. What we're saying there is, if you had stuff, so in a conventional language, what you would do is, the equivalent thing would be something else, and then callback. And then some stuff. This is what it normally would look like. Is you would have your function, you do something, and then you do this callback. Instead, we get rid of this is the stuff that would happen afterwards. Instead of it being there, we put it here. And then what do? Here? We return. Why are we doing this? What we've done is we've taken this computation and put here is foo, and then here's callback. Now, we could have put callback here, but then if we execute all the foo and then execute all the callback, that's more time where we aren't servicing any other requests. We're tying up the event loop. We want to keep going around here so we have keep everyone happy. So instead what we've done is we've gotten rid of this and moved it here to make it standalone. This is where closures help you out because they let you keep the state you need here and have me called in a different context, but it'll still have the state it needs to do stuff. But you're splitting up a function that normally would be have two pieces, you're now putting that second piece in the callback. And you might say, well, darn it! I just wanted to write sequential code. If I want to start writing sequential code and I start putting all these callbacks in, my code looks like crap. You're right. So don't do it. If you're writing a lot of sequential code with a lot of I/O in Node, you're doing it wrong. Don't do it. The entire design of Node is to not do that. And the very structure of the language fights you on that. And that's not a bug. That's a feature. And that's a feature because if you want to make a scalable web application, you need to divide your code up into these small chunks, each of which runs completion so that each one completes so you get more requests coming in between them. That's just how you make a high-performance web server. This is what I was talking about a bit when you say, does Node scale and stuff like that? Actually, the entire design of Node is for scaling, is to be really fast. Yes?
Except, of course, if you actually have some discrete processing task that cannot be effectively chopped up.
This is the event loop. Node is designed to build fast event loops
for web servers. Full stop. That is its reason for being. That is what it does best. If you want to do an intensive computation as part of an incoming request, you don't do it in Node. You don't do it in your main event loop. Because you're going to slow things down.
You're going to make one of these things get really big, and your web server is just going to stop servicing incoming requests. You're breaking the design. I'm not saying you can't do a big computation with it. How do you do it? You fork off a process. You fork off something. You say, oh, I need to do something. You either fork it off, or you contact another process on the system, send it a message. That's how you design it. If you're putting lots of complex logic that's going to slow down your main process, you know, doing lots of I/O, no. you haven't architected it right.
So you're saying this is all single process, no threads, but surely to wait on I/O, there must be some other thread somewhere. Is that just B8 and that's it?
I would have to look. I'm not sure exactly how it's implemented. But it doesn't have to be implemented with the second thread. Yeah, it's a process. I mean, it can just be running one. And the idea is that the operating system itself provides support for asynchronous I/O. So what happens is, as long as your I/O libraries use the asynchronous ones, the OS will contact you and maybe invoke a signal handler or something like that. It will come into your process to tell you to do X, Y, and Z. So you don't actually have to have multiple threads in your process at all.
It just has a supervisor task or whatever function that kicks in.
No. It's just that when a function returns a node and it kind of gets to the bottom of its call stack, you get to this loop and it looks, what should I do next?
Right.
And the node process terminates when there's nothing left to do. And if you're doing a web server, what gets registered in there is a little thing that checks whether there's any incoming request. That's what the listen does. And that little stub of code puts it in the queue, and then starts off another one and says, okay, now for listen, what function am I supposed to call? Oh, let's instantiate that function, call it with the right argument, stick it in our thing, let it go. But with the understanding, it's not going to take very long to run. If it has to do anything that's going to require a long time, it will split it up. Anything that's going to take a long time in terms of I/O. If it's going to take a long time in terms of CPU, you're just screwed. So don't do it. But in modern systems, the amount of computation you can do, when I say short, it still can be rather substantial. But if you start doing something really computationally intensive, you don't do it in the main loop of your web server. That's not the place to do it. You send it off somewhere else. So like a lot of people criticize Node because like, wait, I can't put my complex business logic in my web server. And to that I say, it's not supposed to be there. You can't make a high-performance web server and have it be in there. So, well, I don't care about it being high-performance. Then don't use Node. You know, that's not what it's for. I mean, you put your business, where should you put your business logic? So when I say business logic, what am I talking about?
So this is
what I'm talking about databases. This is where we're talking about the data store. Business logic is about maintaining rules and relationships amongst the data that you have. Things like every time you have an invoice, you have a record that describes that customer. The separate tables. It's about connecting the pieces of the tables. And this is what gets into relational databases. Relational databases and business logic go hand in hand. They co-evolve. They work very well for each other. Node wasn't built for doing those kinds of things. If you want to do those kind of things, you put the business logic into another process, like the database. You don't put it into your mainline web server. The web, the main node web server is supposed to be really light, and if you want to do something computationally heavy, you put another process on the server, or you send it to the client. Let it deal. Do client-side JavaScript.
Yes?
Can you make a system call from node?
Yes, that's what node does all the time.
Like, you can fork a process.
Yeah. You have access all to the standard I/O thing. The one thing, it only gives you access to asynchronous type operations.
So you can write your business logic in C and then have node run fast.
Well, the idea is that if you're running a big process on every incoming request and have to do lots of logic, you're not building a scalable web server. That's just not how you build it. Really, web servers, if you want to serve some data, send to the client, and let it do the computation there. Well, so when you register a callback, what happens is inside foo, it does some stuff, which basically means eventually it gets to an IO function, probably, which says, let me do the IO function. And when you do the IO function, you give it the callback. So this gets passed along, like you want to do a read. So this gets passed along as the read, and then once the read has happened, everything is needed has been done, and then you can continue the computation. And so that function then sticks the callback in this queue, but said, don't run this until this operation completes.
So that loop could go over the callback.
Yes, it can skip it. So in scheduling terms, it's known as a blocked task. It's not ready to be run. It doesn't have all its requirements met. And that's, in fact, this will be potentially queued up with lots of things of all the incoming requests that are waiting to be finished, but their conditions haven't been met. Like, you made a request to the database. Give me some data. That hasn't come back yet. So you're waiting. But while you're waiting, you're doing other things.
Is there anything conceptually wrong with forking up another node process to do your computation?
You could. Now, the only thing is, if you do it in node, if you're doing lots of sequential, you want to do sequential code, using blocking I/O calls, is going to be painful because Node doesn't normally support it.
Yeah, but I mean,
yeah.
If
logically, there's no thing, but Node is really not optimized for that. So you might run into problems.
Non-user-driven computation that happens in the background on regularly scheduled
things.
So instead of tying up the event loop once an hour for 5 minutes,
yep.
You just work it off and you have this thing.
Yeah.
But I guess at that point, you have to consider the advantages of doing it, like you said, maybe in C.
Or Perl, or Python.
Right.
Whatever. Doesn't matter. Node is not it is a full programming language, but it is designed for a very specific niche. And it's that way on the server, because really on the client, that's also how JavaScript works. It's very event-driven. This architecture gives you a potentially very high-performance web server in the sense of it can handle lots of concurrent requests. But the reason it can handle lots of concurrent requests is because it's not doing much work per request. And if you try to make it do a lot of work in the node process per request, you lose all the advantages. All gone. So, how does this relate to databases? So in a modern web application, the database is often where, all the stuff I've done to say, I'm not going to do much computation here. I'm not going to maintain much state here. I'm going to make everything really lightweight. Well, it had to go somewhere. And typically where it goes is the data store. The database gets all the hard work. And the big hard work it gets is the concurrency problem. So the thing what I want to talk about here is ACID. Have you heard of ACID?
Okay, so most of you probably haven't. Hello, can I? There we go. So ACID refers to
this is about database transactions. I'm going to talk about the properties, and I'll talk about database transactions. So, pronunciation here. Atomicity?
Yep.
Atomicity, consistency, isolation, and durability. So, when you think about a database, you have to think about it as a persistent, it's a large, potentially decentralized, distributed data structure. It's a big data structure optimized for concurrent access. And concurrent access, well, it's not just one data structure, it's really a set of data structures that are persistent, interconnected. This is a complex mess of stuff. And when you talk about business logic, what you're talking about is putting constraints on that data structure, saying that there should be certain invariants that hold on that data. If you're going to start messing with that data structure, you have problems of basically corrupting it, messing up the pointers, messing up the rules that go through. You have to be very careful in how you change it. And so ACID semantics are designed to make it so that you can make changes to a database in a highly concurrent environment in a sane way. Because a database doesn't just handle one request at a time. It should handle lots of requests. That's what a database is for. Just like Node is designed to handle lots of requests, but here it's designed to handle lots of requests in a standalone way. You know, by not doing much work for each of them and just servicing the requests as they go. The database, the buck stops there. So some databases often are multi-threaded, the other things, but the important thing from the outside is it's a black box that provides certain guarantees. You normally talk to it over a network connection, you make requests, and then it gives you responses. It's its own kind of server. But so atomicity means that you're going to be doing a complex transformation of the data structure. You want that, any of those transformations, you want them all to happen or none of them to happen. You don't want to, if you have to change three tables at once because the thing you're trying to change is connected in three tables, you want the changes to all three of them to go through at once or none of them. If you don't have that, if you have things, if it gets divided up so like it happened to table one and three but not table two, now your data structure is in an inconsistent state. How do you reason about it? You know, all your proofs of correctness and everything are out the window. So, bad news. So you want things to be atomic. So atomic means that so this is when we're saying a transaction. All a transaction is bunching a bunch of changes to the database in one group and saying this all belongs together. So all of it happens or none of it happens. So consistency, it says that any transactions will bring the data from one valid state to another. So when we talk about consistency, we're typically talking about the business logic. It's not just that table A and table B and table C are connected by this key, but that, oh, wow, these three fields should always add up to 100. You know, simple thing is saying that here are five numbers. They're each percentages, and those five numbers should always total to 100%. What happens if all of a sudden they now total to 105%? It's garbage. You violated the thing. So how do you make sure that happens? You put business logic, you put logic in there that checks after, as part of every change to the database, that adding up those five fields equals 100%. And if it ever does that, it says, oh, I can't commit that. I can't make that change. It's not a consistent change. Reject it. It's all about trying to protect the integrity of the data. Because the things we're talking about here are typically, terabytes or something in size. I mean, there's lots of data. Well, actually, business databases don't have to be that big. But they're important. There's a lot of money tied up in. So isolation and durability. So durability is simple. It just means You change it, it's going to stay changed. You pull the power on, the plug on it, you do all the things, it's been committed to the database. You don't want to lose data.
And isolation means that you may be doing these things, you know, at the same time. Like there may be 50, you know, connections coming into the database at the same time, all with requests. The semantics should be the same as if each of them was executed one at a time. They should be isolated. They shouldn't be messing with each other. It shouldn't matter what order you do with them in. Unless they're changing the same data, then it should impose a certain order. But if they're modifying separate parts of the database, it should just be modifying separate, and they shouldn't interfere at all. Isolate them as much as possible.
So if you look at these, if you think of a database as just a data structure, these things all make sense. But where things get weird is when you realize that databases nowadays don't necessarily exist on just one computer. You potentially are running databases that run on a cluster. You know, 10, you know, not multi-cores, a cluster. So now you've got this whole big system. How do you maintain all these properties on something that's running across, you know, 100 computers? Well, turns out you don't. And that's the story of NoSQL.
When you talk about transaction processing is the reason why SQL was developed, is why relational databases were developed. It was all about business requirements and saying that I want to, so the classic example is I'm booking a ticket on an airline. I want to reserve my seats. I want to make sure the payment goes through. I need to have that all happen at once. I don't want to reserve a seat and, record a special meal or something and not get a payment. Well, I don't want the payment to go through and not have reserved them a seat. I need to have my changes all happen at once, all be consistent, all fit together. And I want that, so I care about integrity, durability, I care about the data being saved properly, and performance, I want that too, because I want my system to scale, but normally this was what mainframes were designed for. Big centralized systems. They were built, IBM made its money on transaction processing. IBM is still arguably the best. Oracle's the other people who say, we can do it too. And why do you pay big bucks for an Oracle database system? It's because it gives you these kind of guarantees when running over lots and lots of data. But even so, you're limited in your scalability because those are really tight constraints. Transactions are hard. If every change to your database requires a transaction kind of semantics, that basically involves typically a kind of locking. And there are other ways to implement, but you're locking rows of the table or entire tables or something. And all the stuff I talked to you about multi-threaded programming is there in databases, but worse. And the database designers have done it. They do it very well, reliably, but they pay a price in performance when you do full transactional semantics. When you do full ACID semantics, it's slow. So whenever people talk about NoSQL, they're saying, I want a persistent data store, and I don't need something this fancy. I don't need full ACID semantics. So sometimes they use the term BASE or something. It's another acronym or something it's a bit of a backronym. But, well, BASE wasn't used in the first place. So, I guess related to ACID. So we have things like eventual consistency when you talk about it. So after every change to an ACID type database, what are examples of this? Like PostgreSQL, a nice Oracle instance, modern versions of MySQL, they can provide these kind of semantics. So when you make the change, the whole database has the same perspective. When you're talking about a distributed database of the NoSQL variety, what can happen is parts of the database know about the change and other parts don't.
So depending upon which part of the database gets your request, you may get the old version or you may get the new version. And if you really care about getting one version or the other version, you have to, it's up to your program to figure it out. So have you ever seen this kind of weirdness in a web application?
Yes.
Yes. So this is the things like, have you tried using Gmail on multiple computers at the same time?
Yep.
Have you noticed that the changes to your inbox don't happen quite at the same time? It's like you change it on one, you delete the message, and you go to the other one, it's like, it's there still. Oh, there, wait, wait.
Mm-hmm. Facebook is great for in-Canada messaging, but if you're actually corresponding with someone on the other side of the globe, like, say, I don't know, friends, not even that far, but obviously it's a different cluster, messages will disappear and reappear, and sometimes they're just gone for days. You can search for them explicitly and they'll come up, but if you actually go to your history or whatever, it doesn't, and eventually,
it all shows up, it all figures it out. This is what eventual consistency is. It means that you don't have the same view of the data from different parts of the system. Yes?
Is this what MongoDB does?
Yes. If you're running it in a clustered instance. Which you can. I mean, that's the whole design of typically of these things is that they don't provide really strong consistency guarantees. I mean, there's ways to enforce consistency to make sure it happens, right now and stuff, but you have to tell it. And the reason why the trade-off you get for this is that you get speed. And for a lot of times for web applications, what you have to first have is the speed, because you've got to scale. And if you don't scale, you have nothing. Although, honestly, if you can use a relational database and you need these kind of things, it's probably going to keep you saner if you start having to deal with real concurrency. But other kinds of systems, where, like, for example, let's say all the data of your system is isolated to individual users, then, individual users are probably not going to be accessing the same data store concurrently. They'll be accessing on this computer, and they'll take a break, and they'll go to this computer, and they'll access it there. Then, consistency will work out.
But nobody in their right mind would do financial transactions with.
No.
Because otherwise you could just game it like crazy.
Yeah, you do not store like any sort of like e-commerce kind of thing where you have to have strong, business logic, consistency and stuff, and where you don't put that in a NoSQL database if you could at all help it. If you do put it in there, you're implementing some approximation of ACID semantics in your own code. You have to do it instead of the database having taken care of it for you. You're making your life much harder. So this is where you have to use the right technology for the job. If you're trying to do lots of business logic in your web server, Node is not going to work well for you. If you're trying to build an application with a database with lots of, where you need a consistent view of the data at all times, don't use a NoSQL type database. MongoDB won't do it. But then again, the relational databases are very rigid and they aren't that high performance relative to these NoSQL things. So it's your requirements. Know your application. Know what you're willing to live with and choose the right thing. And for most of you all, when you're doing leaderboards on a single system and stuff like that, probably, the NoSQL one will probably be fine. But if you really want, like, those leaderboards, like, to be very consistent or something like that, maybe you want a full database.
StarCraft or World of Warcraft.
So those kind of things, when you're talking about these MMOs and stuff like that, they do their own versions of eventual consistency. Because if you try to make a large distributed simulation consistent all the time, you can't scale. You can't run them more than a couple of dozen servers. This is where things like sharding happens, where you're really
building separate instances of the world. They're all kind of loosely connected. That way, you have strong consistencies within it, and then when you transition between them, things are kind of a little looser.
So that's like having
the
world be in blocks or regions, kind of thing.
Yes. That's why online worlds tend to be divided up into areas. You have strong guarantees of consistency inside that area, and then you don't have to bother coordinating the state of that one with the other area.
And they're literally on
different
servers in different areas.
Yes,
you
different clusters typically.
Potentially game it by figuring out where the boundary is and obnoxiously jumping and doing things that would mess with consistency.
They know about this, and they generally design their systems so that isn't very feasible. But people have done that.
And if a new MMO comes out, if you're one of the first people in there, look for the seams. Because you can probably find some way of messing with it. Because if it's a new system, they probably haven't worked out all the bugs.
Selling the object back and forth, like you sold it, boom, you still have it.
Exactly. Actually, yeah, exactly. You're on one side of the thing, you sell it, and then you immediately go to another region, and you still have the item. Sell it again. You know, you can sell it twice.
You'll have both the monies at some point.
Or what you do is you drop it there, and so now you drop the item in the other place. Now it's shown that you don't have it, but it's shown you don't have it for different reasons. Now you can pick it up, and now you have it again.
So in the context of our applications,
yes,
this is really just giving us a peek of what's happening inside of Node. Is the expectation that I should be looking for areas to be building callbacks into my code?
What I'm saying is when you're building your code, you don't have to worry about building callbacks. Node forces you to do callbacks. Those are the only things, because when you do I/O operations, you're using Node primitives. Follow the Express framework. Do the callbacks that it's giving you. Just keep in mind, if you try doing something really elaborate in there, you start doing I/O and you start finding your callbacks are nested on top of each other, realize that you're making a design error. If the nesting gets too deep, you're probably not separating things out. You're probably need to refactor things. You're probably trying to do something that your system should be waiting on, and it should be waiting somewhere else. Something else should be handling this, and then it should come back. And then just make something else do that. What else does that? Whatever. But most of your web applications probably won't be doing that much logic on the server. I mean, if you're doing, let's say, some sort of simulation of a world or something, you're doing stuff on the server, but most of the work's in the database. You know, you're just accessing that state. The heavy lifting is not in the main thing. If you have to do periodic computations on it, do them in the database, or do have another process talk to the database and do the analysis there and store the results in the database so the web server can access it. If you have to do some, if your backend's going to do some sort of waiting on some other network operation, like you're grabbing something from a web service, Node should potentially send off the request and then say, well, I'm still waiting. I'll wait. And then you have a progress bar on the client side that keeps polling the server periodically to check to see what's happening, or it sets up an AJAX callback. Yes?
Can you cover that at some point, the AJAX callback business with the client to server interaction?
So what's the basic logic of it?
So that whole thing about coming in with a request and not having the data to service it, so returning basically an empty template where the client side.
So all you're doing is when you're doing gets from the client, and when you do the get to the server will, the server doesn't have the data, it just responds back and saying, I don't have the data. And then, so you just, every return from the server returns immediately. But maybe the first one says, okay, now I'll schedule another thing to make the request from another server, and then it will populate the database when that comes in, and then you make the request again, and then you'll get the right result.
So you need some sort of cookies or session management to not fire off the initial request for it every time you ask for something that isn't there yet? Basically, like...
Right. Okay, but you just have to check to see in your Node process, like, do you already have a pending request? Like, you just make capable little data structure of saying pending outgoing requests.
Okay.
and the response was not a full-blown HTML page.
It doesn't have to be a full-blown HTML page. That's a nice thing about Ajax. You can just send a little fragment back.
Does Express support that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, what about locking in Node? Do you do any sort of locking of data structures in Node?
No, everything's single-threaded.
There's only one thread. There is no locking to do. First of all, it's single threaded, and there is no interruption. There is no preemption. You need locking if you have single threads, but you have preemption. That means that whatever you're doing can be interrupted. Your code is never interrupted in Node. You give up control. Your function returns. When you call another function, it will return too. Any of your call stacks, you'll go ch-ch-ch-ch, and it will come all the way back. If there's anything there that required a long time, it'll send off a request, and then you'll have given it a callback, and then things will come back. Your functions all should terminate quickly. If you ever write a function and you think it's going to take a long time to execute, something's wrong. You may have made a request that you're going to have to wait on, then there should have been some other piece that's going to deal with it later, and that you're stuck in a callback. Just another function. Remember? The thing you had to wait on, just put it over here. That's what happens when you're putting in a callback.
Mm-hmm. When the callback executes, it's not interrupting anything, it's just the event loop is just eventually
getting to it. Because its conditions have been met. Like it may have been wrapped as saying, call this callback when this IO operation completes. The IO operation is complete, the data is now in the buffer, we can now call the callback with the appropriate arguments, and now it's run. So a callback is never, you never interrupt a function in Node, and a callback, a function is never interrupted, and so you always know that the callback is being called at the time it's supposed to be. So it's what I like about this as a concurrency model is that you don't have to worry about multiple things happening at the same time. You just have to get your head around, okay, this code needs to execute in this condition. But you have to not think about lots of deep sequential programming. If you try implementing this stuff with long sequences of code, doing multiple I/O things, you know, do open file A, then open file B, then open file C, it's going to look gross. Because you'll open file A and have a callback here, and that callback will then go and try to file B, and then you have another callback and a call C. And so people talk about having these callback stacks. And people thought, well, we can avoid the callback stack if we had coroutines. And it's true, there are ways of doing cooperative multitasking. If you look in the literature of programming languages, they're using things called coroutines or promises or other ways of doing things. But the fact is, to make a high-performance web server, you can't be doing too much anyway. If you start needing that sort of sophisticated concurrency management, you're going to make a slow web server. Because you're just doing things. I mean, you're basically getting an incoming request, you need to do a little bit of work, and then send the return back. That's the basic design of it. If you're going to be doing heavy lifting, do it elsewhere. Yes?
So if you're expecting your web server to get a lot of incoming requests, would you use a stream to all the requests?
No. The whole point is Node handles lots of incoming requests. That's what I mean by scaling. There's no, you don't buffer. The way you handle lots of incoming requests is you need to process them as they come. What Node does effectively is it buffers them up for you. As a request comes in, your code immediately runs and does something, and then if there's any hard work, it puts it there. Because every chunk of work it does is very small, it's always ready for the next request. So a lot of callback need a lot of events. So it can have lots and lots of these things waiting. This can get quite large because it just has things to do. Huh? Because your memory. And it just depends on like how, but that's really related to how many
I/O operations you have outstanding. I mean, eventually you'll fall over, but the fact is you've got your concurrency is limited by memory and how many I/O operations you have waiting. And basically, you're putting minimum overhead over the I/O capabilities of your box. If you're doing lots of computation in, but if you do lots of computation in there, you're putting overhead. You need to big computation, put it somewhere else. And you have to, in thinking about your design of your application, think about, why is my web server doing a lot of computation? Shouldn't that computation have been done elsewhere? Shouldn't it have been pre-computed by another process? Should it be done by a separate, process talking to the database? Should you run as a cron job or something? That's what's supposed to handle the long-term stuff. Node, keep it light. So, let's go back and see, did I miss anything here? This is what I want, the final thing. So, for those of you who know, I can just talk quickly about terminology here when you start looking at databases. So, but you see that how this connection between concurrency, Node has a certain way of doing concurrency and databases have another level of concurrency. And the common pattern is to scale up, you have to make sacrifices. In Node, the sacrifice is you're giving up on blocking I/O because blocking I/O is going to cost you and the cost of scheduling is too much, so we're going to get rid of that, and so we have to deal with the overhead of dealing with callbacks. And yeah, I could have given you some way of doing cooperative I/O, a cooperative multitasking in a cleaner way, but you shouldn't be doing too much of it anyway. So if the callbacks start looking nasty, that's the constraint. Now, databases... So here, when you're talking about SQL, you're talking about, here's the daemons. So it's a database. MongoDB says it's a collection rather than a table. Why don't they call them tables in MongoDB? It's not a full relation. Not every field is present. So here, you have rows and columns. You have documents and fields. Any particular document can have any particular field. In a relational database, the rows and columns follow a fixed schema. Every column has a certain type associated with it. Every row has every column in a given table. It's a full grid. But with MongoDB, it's just a collection. It's a collection of documents. The documents have certain fields. Document A may have these fields, and document B may have other ones. If you want to put some more structure on it, you can. If you use something like Mongoose, it actually implements schemas, which is kind of cool. If you want, it gives you a bit of a data model for it. But the underlying system, MongoDB, does not. Now note, from a database evolution standpoint, if you ever have to modify a table in classical relational database, it's a big deal. But adding a new field to in a MongoDB thing, it's like, whatever. It's flexible. But you still have indices. So joins. Oh, I did not talk about joins. Okay, I'll talk about joins in a second. But what joins are is making queries of databases. The primary... What you're doing really with MongoDB is you aren't doing joins, you're just linking together data structures. You're saying, I've got this field here, I've got this field here, they're the same, now I can compute a relationship. Full SQL-type databases, full relational databases have lots of automatic mechanisms for connecting tables together. In MongoDB, you're doing it manually. You're building your own queries and you're assembling them together. Now, the advantage is you're full flexible. You've got a full programming language in how to do this. Disadvantage is doing... Dave isn't doing this work for you. Primary key, this is is automatically set to the ID field. You specify unique things. So every document has an ID that's unique. And then the aggregation stuff. So let me cover just quickly joins.
This is ID field of the record.
Did I not put join in this list? What?
The ID field is to be supplied or does Mongo supply?
MongoDB automatically generates an ID for every document. So every document automatically has a unique ID.
So
I don't think I can explain.
All a join is you have a table of invoices and you have a table of customers, and you want to get the invoice with the customer's name and address. Using a join, you combine the two tables to get a new table, logically, that you can either save or just use on the fly, which has the combined information. There's multiple kinds of joins depending upon the semantics of how you connect those two. What happens when one record here refers to an identifier that isn't present in the other table? How do you reconcile that? And the different kinds of joins there. Normally you do inner joins, and the inner joins, everything has to be present. And otherwise they get left out. An outer join, depending on the kind of outer join, it either includes inputs and nulls in for the parts you don't have. So, but again, if you're doing MongoDB, you aren't doing joins, you're just manually connecting the collections of databases together. But in fact, the way MongoDB does it, when you have the field, you can have sub-collections. It supports that. So think of, to a first approximation, MongoDB stores JSON. So whatever sort of, that's why it kind of goes with things like Node very well, because you just have a data structure, you want to nest it and stuff, the way you do it in a JSON data structure, you can store that in there.
Okay, you'll see some stuff going up in the next week. Get some code up, and happy coding.
Yeah.